contemplating their navels, and then had the gall to ask for lark's livers at the table. Aureliano Segundo took the children to look at the encyclopedia, as always, and Fernanda pretended to straighten out Meme's room, just so that he could listen to her muttering, of course, that it certainly took cheek for him to tell the poor innocents that there was a picture of Colonel Aureliano Buendia in the encyclopedia. During the afternoon, while the children were having their nap, Aureliano Segundo sat on the porch, and Fernanda pursued him even there, provoking him, tormenting him, hovering about him with her implacable horsefly buzzing, saying that, of course, while there was nothing to eat except stones, her husband was sitting there like a sultan of Persia, watching it rain, because that was all he was, a slob, a sponge, a good-for-nothing, softer than cotton batting, used to living off women and convinced that he had married Jonah's wife, who was so content with the story of the whale. Aureliano Segundo listened to her for more than 2 hours, impassive, as if he were deaf. He did not interrupt her until late in the afternoon, when he could no longer bear the echo of the bass drum that was tormenting his head. "Please, shut up," he begged. Fernanda, quite the contrary, raised her pitch. "I don't have any reason to shut up," she said. "Anyone who doesn't want to listen to me can go someplace else." Then Aureliano Segundo lost control. He stood up unhurriedly, as if he only intended to stretch, and with a perfectly regulated and methodical fury, he grabbed the pots with the begonias one after the other, those with the ferns, the oregano, and one after the other, he smashed them onto the floor. Fernanda was frightened because until then she had really not had a clear indication of the tremendous inner force of her sing-song, but it was too late for any attempt at rectification. Intoxicated by the uncontained torrent of relief, Aureliano Segundo broke the glass on the china closet, and piece by piece, without hurrying, he took out the chinaware and shattered it on the floor, systematically, serenely, in the same parsimonious way in which he had papered the house with banknotes. He then set about smashing the bohemian crystalware against the walls, the hand-painted vases, the pictures of maidens in flower-laden boats, the mirrors in their gilded frames, everything that was breakable, from parlour to pantry. And he finished with the large earthen jar in the kitchen, which exploded in the middle of the courtyard with a hollow boom. Then he washed his hands, threw the oilcloth over himself, and before midnight he returned with a few strings of dried meat, several bags of rice, corn with weevils, and some emaciated bunches of bananas. From then on there was no more lack of food. Amaranta Ursula and little Aureliano would remember the rains as a happy time. In spite of Fernanda's strictness, they would splash in the puddles in the courtyard, catch lizards and dissect them, and pretend that they were poisoning the soup with dust from butterfly wings when Santa Sofia de la Piedad was not looking. Ursula was their most amusing plaything. They looked upon her as a big, broken-down doll that they carried back and forth from one corner to another, wrapped in coloured cloth, and with her face painted with soot and anato, and once they were on the point of plucking out her eyes with the pruning shears, as they had done with the frogs. Nothing gave them as much excitement as the wanderings of her mind. Something, indeed, must have happened to her mind during the third year of the rain, for she was gradually losing her sense of reality, and confusing present time with remote periods in her life, to the point where, on one occasion, she spent 3 days weeping deeply over the death of Petronila Iguaran, her great-grandmother, buried for over a century. She sank into such an insane state of confusion that she thought little Aureliano was her son, the colonel, during the time he was taken to see ICE, and that the José Arcadio, who was at that time in the seminary, was her firstborn, who had gone off with the gypsies. She spoke so much about the family that the children learned to make up imaginary visits with beings who had not only been dead for a long time, but who had existed at different times. Sitting on the bed, her hair covered with ashes and her face wrapped in a red kerchief, Ursula was happy in the midst of the unreal relatives whom the children described in all detail, as if they had really known them. Ursula would converse with her forebears about events that took place before her own existence, enjoying the news they gave her, and she would weep with them over deaths that were much more recent than the guests themselves. The children did not take long to notice that, in the course of those ghostly visits, Ursula would always ask a question, destined to establish the one who had brought a life-size plaster St. Joseph to the house, to be kept until the rain stopped. It was in that way that Aureliano II remembered the fortune buried in some place that only Ursula knew. But the questions and astute manoeuvring that occurred to him were of no use, because in the labyrinth of her madness, she seemed to preserve enough of a margin of lucidity to keep the secret, which she would reveal only to the one who could prove that he was the real owner of the buried gold. She was so skillful and strict that when Aureliano II instructed one of his carousing companions to pass himself off as the owner of the fortune, she got him all caught up in a minute interrogation sown with subtle traps. Convinced that Ursula would carry the secret to her grave, Aureliano II hired a crew of diggers, under the pretext that they were making some drainage canals in the courtyard and the backyard, and he himself took soundings in the earth with iron bars and all manner of metal detectors, without finding anything that resembled gold in 3 months of exhaustive exploration. Later on he went to Pilar Tenera, with the hope that the cards would see more than the diggers, but she began by explaining that any attempt would be useless, unless Ursula cut the cards. On the other hand, she confirmed the existence of the treasure with the precision of its consisting of 7,214 coins, buried in 3 canvas sacks, reinforced with copper wire, within a circle with a radius of 388 feet, with Ursula's bed as the centre, but she warned that it would not be found until it stopped raining, and the suns of 3 consecutive dunes had changed the piles of mud into dust. The profusion and meticulous vagueness of the information seemed to Aureliano II so similar to the tales of spiritualists that he kept on with his enterprise in spite of the fact that they were in August, and they would have to wait at least 3 years in order to satisfy the conditions of the prediction. The first thing that startled him, even though it increased his confusion at the same time, was the fact that it was precisely 388 feet from Ursula's bed to the backyard wall. Fernanda feared that he was as crazy as his twin brother when she saw him taking the measurements, and even more when he told the digging crew to make the ditches 3 feet deeper. Overcome by an exploratory delirium, comparable only to that of his great-grandfather when he was searching for the root of inventions, Aureliano II lost the last layers of fat that he had left, and the old resemblance to his twin brother was becoming accentuated again, not only because of his slim figure, but also because of the distant air and the withdrawn attitude. He no longer bothered with the children. He ate at odd hours, muddied from head to toe, and he did so in a corner of the kitchen, barely answering the occasional questions asked by Santa Sofia de la Piedad. Seeing him work that way, as she had never dreamed him capable of doing, Fernanda thought that his stubbornness was diligence, his greed abnegation, and his thick-headedness perseverance, and her insides tightened with remorse over the virulence with which she had attacked his idleness. But Aureliano II was in no mood for merciful reconciliations at that time. Sunk up to his neck in a morass of dead branches and rotting flowers, he flung the dirt of the garden all about, after having finished with the courtyard and the backyard, and he excavated so deeply under the foundations of the east wing of the house that one night they woke up in terror at what seemed to be an earthquake, as much because of the trembling as the fearful underground creaking. 3 of the rooms were collapsing, and a frightening crack had opened up from the porch to Fernanda's room. Aureliano II did not give up the search because of that. Even when his last hopes had been extinguished, and the only thing that seemed to make any sense was what the cards had predicted, he reinforced the jagged foundation, repaired the crack with mortar, and continued on the side to the west. He was still there on the 2nd week of the following June when the rain began to abate and the clouds began to lift, and it was obvious from one moment to the next that it was going to clear. That was what happened. One Friday at 2 in the afternoon, the world lighted up with a crazy crimson sun as harsh as brick dust and almost as cool as water, and it did not rain again for 10 years. Macondo was in ruins. In the swampy streets, there were the remains of furniture, animal skeletons covered with red lilies, the last memories of the hordes of newcomers who had fled Macondo as wildly as they had arrived. The houses that had been built with such haste during the banana fever had been abandoned. The banana company tore down its installations. All that remained of the former wired-in city were the ruins. The wooden houses, the cool terraces for breezy card-playing afternoons, seemed to have been blown away in an anticipation of the prophetic wind that years later would wipe Macondo off the face of the earth. The only human trace left by that voracious blast was a glove belonging to Patricia Brown in an automobile smothered in wild pansies. The enchanted region explored by José Arcadio Buendía in the days of the founding, where later on the banana plantations flourished, was a bog of rotting roots, on the horizon of which one could manage to see the silent foam of the sea. Aureliano Secundo went through a crisis of affliction on the first Sunday that he put on dry clothes and went out to renew his acquaintance with the town. The survivors of the catastrophe, the same ones who had been living in Macondo before it had been struck by the Banana Company hurricane, were sitting in the middle of the street, enjoying their first sunshine. They still had the green of the algae on their skin and the musty smell of a corner that had been stamped on them by the rain, but in their hearts they seemed happy to have recovered the town in which they had been born. The Street of the Turks was again what it had been earlier, in the days when the Arabs, with slippers and rings in their ears, were going about the world, swapping knick-knacks for macaws, and had found in Macondo a good bend in the road, where they could find respite from their age-old lot as wanderers. Having crossed through to the other side of the rain, the merchandise in the booths was falling apart. The cloths spread over the doors were splotched with mould, the counters undermined by termites, the walls eaten away by dampness. But the Arabs of the third generation were sitting in the same place, and in the same position as their fathers and grandfathers, taciturn, dauntless, invulnerable to time and disaster, as alive or as dead as they had been after the insomnia plague and Colonel Aureliano Buendía's 32 wars. Their strength of spirit in the face of the ruins of the gaming tables, the fritter stands, the shooting galleries, and the alley where they interpreted dreams and predicted the future, made Aureliano Secundo ask them, with his usual informality, what mysterious resources they had relied upon, so as not to have gone awash in the storm, what the devil they had done, so as not to drown. And one after the other, from door to door, they returned a crafty smile and a dreamy look, and without any previous consultation, they all gave the same answer. Swimming. Petra Cotes was perhaps the only native who had an Arab heart. She had seen the final destruction of her stables, her barns dragged off by the storm, but she had managed to keep her house standing. During the second year she had sent pressing messages to Aureliano Secundo, and he had answered that he did not know when he would go back to her house, but that in any case he would bring along a box of gold coins to pave the bedroom floor with. At that time she had dug deep into her heart, searching for the strength that would allow her to survive the misfortune, and she had discovered a reflective and just rage with which she had sworn to restore the fortune squandered by her lover and then wiped out by the deluge. It was such an unbreakable decision that Aureliano Secundo went back to her house 8 months after the last message and found her green, dishevelled, with sunken eyelids and skin spangled with mange, but she was writing out numbers on small pieces of paper to make a raffle. Aureliano Secundo was astonished, and he was so dirty and so solemn that Petra Cotes almost believed that the one who had come to see her was not the lover of all her life, but his twin brother. "You're crazy," he told her, "unless you plan to raffle off bones." Then she told him to look in the bedroom, and Aureliano Secundo saw the mule. Its skin was clinging to its bones like that of its mistress, but it was just as alive and resolute as she. Petra Cotes had fed it with her wrath, and when there was no more hay or corn or roots, she had given it shelter in her own bedroom, and fed it on the percale sheets, the Persian rugs, the plush bedspreads, the velvet drapes, and the canopy embroidered with gold thread and silk tassels on the episcopal bed. Ursula had to make a great effort to fulfill her promise to die when it cleared. The waves of lucidity that were so scarce during the rains became more frequent after August, when an arid wind began to blow, and suffocated the rose bushes, and petrified the piles of mud, and ended up scattering over Macondo the burning dust that covered the rusted zinc roofs and the age-old almond trees forever. Ursula cried in lamentation when she discovered that for more than 3 years she had been a plaything for the children. She washed her painted face, took off the strips of brightly coloured cloth, the dried lizards and frogs, and the rosaries and old Arab necklaces that they had hung all over her body, and for the first time since the death of Amaranta, she got up out of bed without anybody's help to join in the family life once more. The spirit of her invincible heart guided her through the shadows. Those who noticed her stumbling and who bumped into the archangelic arm she kept raised at head level thought that she was having trouble with her body, but they still did not think she was blind. She did not need to see to realize that the flower beds, cultivated with such care since the first rebuilding, had been destroyed by the rain and ruined by Aureliano II's excavations, and that the walls and the cement of the floors were cracked, the furniture mushy and discolored, the doors off their hinges, and the family menaced by a spirit of resignation and despair that was inconceivable in her time. Feeling her way along through the empty bedrooms, she perceived the continuous rumble of the termites as they carved the wood, the snipping of the moths in the clothes closets, and the devastating noise of the enormous red ants that had prospered during the deluge and were undermining the foundations of the house. One day she opened the trunk with the saints and had to ask Santa Sofia de la Piedad to get off her body the cockroaches that jumped out and that had already turned the clothing to dust. "A person can't live in neglect like this," she said. "If we go on like this, we'll be devoured by animals." From then on, she did not have a moment of repose. Up before dawn, she would use anybody available, even the children. She put the few articles of clothing that were still usable out into the sun. She drove the cockroaches off with powerful insecticide attacks. She scratched out the veins that the termites had made on doors and windows and asphyxiated the ants in their anthills with quicklime. The fever of restoration finally brought her to the forgotten rooms. She cleared out the rubble and cobwebs in the room where José Arcadio Buendía had lost his wits, looking for the Philosopher's Stone. She put the silver shop, which had been upset by the soldiers, in order, and lastly, she asked for the keys to Melquiades' room, to see what state it was in. Faithful to the wishes of José Arcadio II, who had forbidden anyone to come in unless there was a clear indication that he had died, Santa Sofia de la Piedad tried all kinds of subterfuges to throw Ursula off the track. But so inflexible was her determination not to surrender even the most remote corner of the house to the insects that she knocked down every obstacle in her path, and after 3 days of insistence, she succeeded in getting them to open the door for her. She had to hold on to the door jamb so that the stench would not knock her over, but she needed only 2 seconds to remember that the schoolgirl's 72 chamber pots were in there, and that on one of the rainy nights, a patrol of soldiers had searched the house looking for José Arcadio II, and had been unable to find him. "Lord, save us!" she exclaimed, as if she could see everything. "So much trouble teaching you good manners, and you end up living like a pig." José Arcadio II was still reading over the parchments. The only thing visible in the intricate tangle of hair was the teeth, striped with green slime, and his motionless eyes. When he recognized his great-grandmother's voice, he turned his head toward the door, tried to smile, and, without knowing it, repeated an old phrase of Ursula's. "What did you expect?" he murmured. "Time passes." "That's how it goes," Ursula said, "but not so much." When she said it, she realized that she was giving the same reply that Colonel Aureliano Buendía had given in his death cell, and once again she shuddered with the evidence that time was not passing, as she had just admitted, but that it was turning in a circle. But even then she did not give resignation a chance. She scolded José Arcadio II as if he were a child, and insisted that he take a bath and shave, and lend a hand in fixing up the house. The simple idea of abandoning the room that had given him peace terrified José Arcadio II. He shouted that there was no human power capable of making him go out, because he did not want to see the train with 200 cars, loaded with dead people, which left Macondo every day at dusk on its way to the sea. "They were all of those who were at the station," he shouted. 3,408. Only then did Ursula realize that he was in a world of shadows more impenetrable than hers, as unreachable and solitary as that of his great-grandfather. She left him in the room, but she succeeded in getting them to leave the padlock off, clean it every day, throw the chamber pots away except for one, and to keep José Arcadio Segundo as clean and presentable as his great-grandfather had been during his long captivity under the chestnut tree. At first, Fernanda interpreted that bustle as an attack of senile madness, and it was difficult for her to suppress her exasperation. But about that time, José Arcadio told her that he planned to come to Macondo from Rome before taking his final vows, and the good news filled her with such enthusiasm that from morning to night she would be seen watering the flowers 4 times a day so that her son would not have a bad impression of the house. It was that same incentive which induced her to speed up her correspondence with the invisible doctors and to replace the pots of ferns and oregano and the begonias on the porch even before Ursula found out that they had been destroyed by Aureliano Segundo's exterminating fury. Later on she sold the silver service and bought ceramic dishes, pewter bowls and soup spoons, and alpaca tablecloths, and with them brought poverty to the cupboards that had been accustomed to India Company chinaware and Bohemian crystal. Ursula always tried to go a step beyond. "Open the windows and the doors," she shouted. "Cook some meat and fish, buy the largest turtles around, let strangers come and spread their mats in the corners and urinate in the rose bushes and sit down to eat as many times as they want, and belch and rant and muddy everything with their boots, and let them do whatever they want to us, because that's the only way to drive off ruin." But it was a vain illusion. She was too old then, and living on borrowed time to repeat the miracle of the little candy animals, and none of her descendants had inherited her strength. The house stayed closed on Fernanda's orders. Aureliano Segundo, who had taken his trunks back to the house of Petracotes, barely had enough means to see that the family did not starve to death. With the raffling of the mule, Petracotes and he bought some more animals with which they managed to set up a primitive lottery business. Aureliano Segundo would go from house to house selling the tickets that he himself painted with colored ink to make them more attractive and convincing, and perhaps he did not realize that many people bought them out of gratitude, and most of them out of pity. Nevertheless, even the most pitying purchaser was getting a chance to win a pig for 20 cents, or a calf for 32, and they became so hopeful that on Tuesday nights, Petracotes's courtyard overflowed with people waiting for the moment when a child, picked at random, drew the winning number from a bag. It did not take long to become a weekly fair, for at dusk, food and drink stands would be set up in the courtyard, and many of those who were favored would slaughter the animals they had won right there, on the condition that someone else supply the liquor and music, so that, without having wanted to, Aureliano Segundo suddenly found himself playing the accordion again, and participating in modest tourneys of veracity. Those humble replicas of the revelry of former times served to show Aureliano Segundo himself how much his spirits had declined, and to what a degree his skill as a masterful carouser had dried up. He was a changed man. The £240 that he had attained during the days when he had been challenged by the elephant had been reduced to 156. The glowing and bloated tortoise face had turned into that of an iguana, and he was always on the verge of boredom and fatigue. For Petracotes, however, he had never been a better man than at that time, perhaps because the pity that he inspired was mixed with love, and because of the feeling of solidarity that misery aroused in both of them. The broken-down bed ceased to be the scene of wild activities, and was changed into an intimate refuge. Freed of the repetitious mirrors, which had been auctioned off to buy animals for the lottery, and from the lewd damasks and velvets, which the mule had eaten, they would stay up very late with the innocence of 2 sleepless grandparents, taking advantage of the time to draw up accounts, and put away pennies which they formerly wasted just for the sake of it. Sometimes the cock's crow would find them piling and unpiling coins, taking a bit away from here to put there, so that this bunch would be enough to keep Fernanda happy, and that would be for Amaranta Ursula's shoes, and that other one for Santa Sofia de la Piedad, who had not had a new dress since the time of all the noise, and this to order the coffin if Ursula died, and this for the coffee, which was going up a cent a pound in price every 3 months, and this for the sugar, which sweetened less every day, and this for the lumber, which was still wet from the rains, and this other one for the paper and the coloured ink to make tickets with, and what was left over to pay off the winner of the April calf, whose hide they had miraculously saved when it came down with a symptomatic carbuncle, just when all of the numbers in the raffle had already been sold. Those rites of poverty were so pure that they nearly always set aside the largest share for Fernanda, and they did not do so out of remorse or charity, but because her well-being was more important to them than their own. What was really happening to them, although neither of them realized it, was that they both thought of Fernanda as the daughter that they would have liked to have and never did, to the point where, on a certain occasion, they resigned themselves to eating crumbs for 3 days so that she could buy a Dutch tablecloth. Nevertheless, no matter how much they killed themselves with work, no matter how much money they eked out, and no matter how many schemes they thought of, their guardian angels were asleep with fatigue while they put in coins and took them out, trying to get just enough to live with. During the waking hours, when the accounts were bad, they wondered what had happened in the world for the animals not to breed with the same drive as before, why money slipped through their fingers, and why people who, a short time before, had burned rolls of bills in the carousing, considered it highway robbery to charge 12 cents for a raffle of 6 hens. Aureliano Segundo thought, without saying so, that the evil was not in the world, but in some hidden place in the mysterious heart of Petracotes, where something had happened during the deluge that had turned the animals sterile and made money scarce. Intrigued by that enigma, he dug so deeply into her sentiments that, in search of interest, he found love, because by trying to make her love him, he ended up falling in love with her. Petracotes, for her part, loved him more and more, as she felt his love increasing, and that was how, in the ripeness of autumn, she began to believe once more in the youthful superstition that poverty was the servitude of love. Both looked back then on the wild revelry, the gaudy wealth, and the unbridled fornication as an annoyance, and they lamented that it had cost them so much of their lives to find the paradise of shared solitude. Madly in love after so many years of sterile complicity, they enjoyed the miracle of loving each other as much at the table as in bed, and they grew to be so happy that even when they were two worn-out old people, they kept on blooming like little children and playing together like dogs. The raffles never got very far. At first Aureliano Segundo would spend 3 days of the week shut up in what had been his rancher's office, drawing ticket after ticket, painting with a fair skill a red cow, a green pig, or a group of blue hens, according to the animal being raffled, and he would sketch out a good imitation of printed numbers, and the name that Petracotes thought good to call the business, Divine Providence Raffles. But with time, he felt so tired after drawing up to 2,000 tickets a week, that he had the animals, the name, and the numbers put on rubber stamps, and then the work was reduced to moistening them on pads of different colours. In his last years, it occurred to him to substitute riddles for the numbers, so that the prize could be shared by all those who guessed it. But the system turned out to be so complicated, and was open to so much suspicion, that he gave it up after the second attempt. Aureliano Segundo was so busy trying to maintain the prestige of his raffles that he barely had time to see the children. Fernanda put Amaranta Ursula in a small private school, where they admitted only 6 girls, but she refused to allow Aureliano to go to public school. She considered that she had already relented too much in letting him leave the room. Besides, the schools in those days accepted only the legitimate offspring of Catholic marriages, and on the birth certificate that had been pinned to Aureliano's clothing when they brought him to the house, he was registered as a foundling. So he remained shut in at the mercy of Santa Sofia della Piedad's loving eyes and Ursula's mental quirks, learning in the narrow world of the house whatever his grandmothers explained to him. He was delicate, thin, with a curiosity that unnerved the adults. But unlike the inquisitive and sometimes clairvoyant look that the colonel had at his age, his look was blinking and somewhat distracted. While Amaranta Ursula was in kindergarten, he would hunt earthworms and torture insects in the garden. But once, when Fernanda caught him putting scorpions in a box to put in Ursula's bed, She locked him up in Mémé's old room, where he spent his solitary hours looking through the pictures in the encyclopedia. Ursula found him there one afternoon when she was going about, sprinkling the house with distilled water and a bunch of nettles, and in spite of the fact that she had been with him many times, she asked him who he was.
"I'm Aureliano Buendía," he said.
"That's right," she replied, "and now it's time for you to start learning how to be a silversmith." She had confused him with her son again, because the hot wind that came after the deluge and had brought occasional waves of lucidity to Ursula's brain had passed. She never got her reason back. When she went into the bedroom, she found Petronila Iguaran there, with the bothersome crinolines and the beaded jacket that she put on for formal visits, and she found Tranquilina Maria Miniata Alacoc Buendía, her grandmother, fanning herself with a peacock feather in her invalid's rocking chair, and her great-grandfather, Aureliano Arcadio Buendía, with his imitation dolman of the vice-regal guard, and Aureliano Iguaran, her father, who had invented a prayer to make the worms shrivel up and drop off cows, and her timid mother, and her cousin with the pig's tail, and José Arcadio Buendía, and her dead sons, all sitting in chairs lined up against the wall, as if it were a wake and not a visit. She was tying a colourful string of chatter together, commenting on things from many separate places and many different times, so that when Amaranta Ursula returned from school, and Aureliano grew tired of the encyclopedia, they would find her sitting on her bed, talking to herself, and lost in a labyrinth of dead people. "Fire!" she shouted once in terror, and for an instant panic spread through the house. But what she was telling about was the burning of a barn that she had witnessed when she was 4 years old. She finally mixed up the past with the present in such a way that in the two or three waves of lucidity that she had before she died, no one knew for certain whether she was speaking about what she felt or what she remembered. Little by little, she was shrinking, turning into a fetus, becoming mummified in life to the point that, in her last months, she was a cherry raisin lost inside of her nightgown, and the arm that she always kept raised looked like the paw of a Maramonda monkey. She was motionless for several days, and Santa Sofia de la Piedad had to shake her to convince herself that she was alive, and sat on her lap to feed her a few spoonfuls of sugar water. She looked like a newborn old woman. Amaranta Ursula and Aureliano would take her in and out of the bedroom. They would lay her on the altar to see if she was any larger than the Christ child, and one afternoon they hid her in a closet in the pantry where the rats could have eaten her. One Palm Sunday they went into the bedroom while Fernanda was in church and carried Ursula out by the neck and ankles. "Poor great-great-grandmother," Amaranta Ursula said. "She died of old age." Ursula was startled. "I'm alive," she said. "You can see," Amaranta Ursula said, suppressing her laughter, "that she's not even breathing." "I'm talking," Ursula shouted. "She can't even talk," Aureliano said. "She died like a little cricket." Then Ursula gave in to the evidence. "My God," she exclaimed in a low voice, "so this is what it's like to be dead." She started an endless, stumbling, deep prayer that lasted more than 2 days, and that by Tuesday had degenerated into a hodgepodge of requests to God and bits of practical advice to stop the red ants from bringing the house down, to keep the lamp burning by Remedios daguerreotype, and never to let any Buendía marry a person of the same blood, because their children would be born with the tail of a pig. Aureliano Segundo tried to take advantage of her delirium to get her to tell him where the gold was buried, but his entreaties were useless once more. "When the owner appears," Ursula said, "God will illuminate him so that he will find it." Santa Sofia de la Piedad had the certainty that they would find her dead from one moment to the next, because she noticed during those days a certain confusion in nature. The roses smelled like goosefoot, a pod of chickpeas fell down, and the beans lay on the ground in a perfect geometrical pattern in the shape of a starfish, and one night she saw a row of luminous orange discs pass across the sky. They found her dead on the morning of Good Friday. The last time that they had helped her calculate her age, during the time of the banana company, she had estimated it as between 115 and 122. They buried her in a coffin that was not much larger than the basket in which Aureliano had arrived, and very few people were at the funeral, partly because there were not many left who remembered her, and partly because it was so hot that noon that the birds in their confusion were running into walls like clay pigeons and breaking through screens to die in the bedrooms. At first they thought it was a plague. Housewives were exhausted from sweeping away so many dead birds, especially at siesta time, and the men dumped them into the river by the cartload. On Easter Sunday, the 100-year-old Father Antonio Isabel stated from the pulpit that the death of the birds was due to the evil influence of the wandering Jew, whom he himself had seen the night before. He described him as a cross between a billy goat and a female heretic, an infernal beast, whose breath scorched the air, and whose look brought on the birth of monsters in newly wed women. There were not many who paid attention to his apocalyptic talk, for the town was convinced that the priest was rambling because of his age. But one woman woke everybody up at dawn on Wednesday because she found the tracks of a biped with a cloven hoof. They were so clear and unmistakable that those who went to look at them had no doubt about the existence of a fearsome creature similar to the one described by the parish priest, and they got together to set traps in their courtyards. That was how they managed to capture it. 2 weeks after Ursula's death, Petra Cotes and Aureliano Segundo woke up frightened by the especially loud bellowing of a calf that was coming from nearby. When they got there, a group of men were already pulling the monster off the sharpened stakes they had set in the bottom of a pit covered with dry leaves, and it stopped lowing. It was as heavy as an ox, in spite of the fact that it was no taller than a young steer, and a green and greasy liquid flowed from its wounds. Its body was covered with rough hair, plagued with small ticks, and the skin was hardened with the scales of a remora fish, but unlike the priest's description, its human parts were more like those of a sickly angel than of a man, for its hands were tense and agile, its eyes large and gloomy, and on its shoulder blades it had the scarred over and calloused stumps of powerful wings, which must have been chopped off by a woodsman's axe. They hung it to an almond tree in the square by its ankles, so that everyone could see it, and when it began to rot, they burned it in a bonfire, for they could not determine whether its bastard nature was that of an animal to be thrown into the river, or a human being to be buried. It was never established whether it had really caused the death of the birds, but the newly married women did not bear the predicted monsters, nor did the intensity of the heat decrease. Rebecca died at the end of that year. Argenida, her lifelong servant, asked the authorities for help to knock down the door to the bedroom where her mistress had been locked in for 3 days, and they found her on her solitary bed, curled up like a shrimp, with her head bald from ringworm and her finger in her mouth. Aureliano Segundo took charge of the funeral and tried to restore the house in order to sell it. But the destruction was so far advanced in it that the walls became scaly as soon as they were painted, and there was not enough mortar to stop the weeds from cracking the floors and the ivy from rotting the beams. That was how everything went after the deluge. The indolence of the people was in contrast to the voracity of oblivion, which little by little was undermining memories in a pitiless way, to such an extreme that at that time, on another anniversary of the Treaty of Neerlandia, some emissaries from the President of the Republic arrived in Macondo to award, at last, the decoration rejected several times by Colonel Aureliano Buendía, and they spent a whole afternoon looking for someone who could tell them where they could find one of his descendants. Aureliano Segundo was tempted to accept it, thinking that it was a medal of solid gold, but Petra Cotes convinced him that it was not proper when the emissaries already had some proclamations and speeches ready for the ceremony. It was also around that time that the gypsies returned, the last heirs to Melquiades' science, and they found the town so defeated, and its inhabitants so removed from the rest of the world, that once more they went through the houses dragging magnetized ingots, as if that really were the Babylonian wise men's latest discovery, and once again they concentrated the sun's rays with the giant magnifying glass. And there was no lack of people standing open-mouthed, watching kettles fall and pots roll, and who paid 50 cents to be startled, as a gypsy woman put in her false teeth and took them out again. A broken-down yellow train, that neither brought anyone in nor took anyone out, and that scarcely paused at the deserted station, was the only thing that was left of the long train to which Mr. Brown would couple his glass-topped coach with the episcopal lounging chairs, and of the fruit trains, with 120 cars, which took a whole afternoon to pass by. The ecclesiastical delegates, who had come to investigate the report of the strange death of the birds and the sacrifice of the wandering Jew, found Father Antonio Isabel playing blind man's buff with the children, and thinking that his report was the product of a hallucination, they took him off to an asylum. A short time later, they sent Father Augusto Angel, a crusader of the new breed, intransigent, audacious, daring, who personally rang the bells several times a day so that the people's spirits would not get drowsy, and who went from house to house, waking up the sleepers to go to Mass. But before a year was out, he too was conquered by the negligence that one breathed in with the air, by the hot dust that made everything old and clogged up, and by the drowsiness caused by lunchtime meatballs in the unbearable heat of siesta time. With Ursula's death, the house again fell into a neglect from which it could not be rescued, even by a will as resolute and vigorous as that of Amaranta Ursula, who, many years later, being a happy, modern woman without prejudices, with her feet on the ground, opened doors and windows in order to drive away the ruin, restored the garden, exterminated the red ants who were already walking across the porch in broad daylight, and tried in vain to reawaken the forgotten spirit of hospitality. Fernanda's cloistered passion built an impenetrable dike against Ursula's torrential 100 years. Not only did she refuse to open doors when the arid wind passed through, but she had the windows nailed shut with boards in the shape of a cross, obeying the paternal order of being buried alive. The expensive correspondence with the invisible doctors ended in failure. After numerous postponements, she shut herself up in her room on the date and hour agreed upon, covered only by a white sheet and with her head pointed north, and at 1 o'clock in the morning she felt that they were covering her head with a handkerchief soaked in a glacial liquid. When she woke up, the sun was shining in the window and she had a barbarous stitch in the shape of an arc that began at her crotch and ended at her sternum. But before she could complete the prescribed rest, she received a disturbed letter from the invisible doctors, who said they had inspected her for 6 hours, without finding anything that corresponded to the symptoms so many times and so scrupulously described by her. Actually, her pernicious habit of not calling things by their names had brought about a new confusion, for the only thing that the telepathic surgeons had found was a drop in the uterus which could be corrected by use of a pessary. The disillusioned Fernanda tried to obtain more precise information, but the unknown correspondence did not answer her letters anymore. She felt so defeated by the weight of an unknown word that she decided to put shame behind her and ask what a pessary was, and only then did she discover that the French doctor had hanged himself to a beam 3 months earlier and had been buried against the wishes of the townspeople by a former companion in arms of Colonel Aureliano Buendia. Then she confided in her son, José Arcadio, and the latter sent her the pessaries from Rome, along with a pamphlet explaining their use, which she flushed down the toilet after committing it to memory, so that no one would learn the nature of her troubles. It was a useless precaution, because the only people who lived in the house scarcely paid any attention to her. Santa Sofia de la Piedad was wandering about in her solitary old age, cooking the little that they ate, and almost completely dedicated to the care of José Arcadio Segundo. Amaranta Ursula, who had inherited certain attractions of Remedios the Beauty, spent the time that she had formerly wasted tormenting Ursula at her schoolwork, and she began to show good judgment and a dedication to study that brought back to Aureliano Segundo the high hopes that Meme had inspired in him. He had promised her to send her to finish her studies in Brussels, in accord with a custom established during the time of the Banana Company, and that illusion had brought him to attempt to revive the lands devastated by the deluge. The few times that he appeared at the house were for Amaranta Ursula, because with time he had become a stranger to Fernanda, and little Aureliano was becoming withdrawn as he approached puberty. Aureliano Segundo had faith that Fernanda's heart would soften with old age, so that the child could join in the life of a town where no one certainly would make any effort to speculate suspiciously about his origins. But Aureliano himself seemed to prefer the cloister of solitude, and he did not show the least desire to know the world that began at the street door of the house. When Ursula had the door of Melquiades' room opened, he began to linger about it, peeping through the half-open door, and no one knew at what moment he became close to José Arcadio Segundo in a link of mutual affection. Aureliano Segundo discovered that friendship a long time after it had begun, when he heard the child talking about the killing at the station. It happened once when someone at the table complained about the ruin into which the town had sunk when the banana company had abandoned it, and Aureliano contradicted him with maturity and with the vision of a grown person. His point of view, contrary to the general interpretation, was that Macondo had been a prosperous place and well on its way, until it was disordered and corrupted and suppressed by the banana company, whose engineers brought on the deluge as a pretext to avoid promises made to the workers. Speaking with such good sense that, to Fernanda, he was like a sacrilegious parody of Jesus among the wise men, the child described with precise and convincing details how the army had machine-gunned more than 3,000 workers, penned up by the station, and how they loaded the bodies onto a 200-car train and threw them into the sea. Convinced, as most people were, by the official version that nothing had happened, Fernanda was scandalized with the idea that the child had inherited the anarchist ideas of Colonel Aureliano Buendía and told him to be quiet. Aureliano Segundo, on the other hand, recognized his twin brother's version. Actually, in spite of the fact that everyone considered him mad, José Arcadio Segundo was at that time the most lucid inhabitant of the house. He taught little Aureliano how to read and write, initiated him in the study of the parchments, and he inculcated him with such a personal interpretation of what the banana company had meant to Macondo that many years later, when Aureliano became part of the world, one would have thought that he was telling a hallucinated version, because it was radically opposed to the false one that historians had created and consecrated in the schoolbooks. In the small isolated room where the arid air never penetrated, nor the dust, nor the heat, both had the atavistic vision of an old man, his back to the window, wearing a hat with a brim like the wings of a crow, who spoke about the world many years before they had been born. Both described at the same time how it was always March there, and always Monday, and then they understood that José Arcadio Buendía was not as crazy as the family said, but that he was the only one who had enough lucidity to sense the truth of the fact that time also stumbled and had accidents, and could therefore splinter and leave an eternalized fragment in a room. José Arcadio Segundo had managed, furthermore, to classify the cryptic letters of the parchments. He was certain that they corresponded to an alphabet of 47 to 53 characters, which, when separated, looked like scratching and scribbling, and which, in the fine hand of Melquiades, looked like pieces of clothing put out to dry on a line. Aureliano remembered having seen a similar table in the English encyclopedia, so he brought it to the room to compare it with that of José Arcadio Segundo. They were indeed the same. Around the time of the riddle lottery, Aureliano Segundo began waking up with a knot in his throat, as if he were repressing a desire to weep. Petra Cotes interpreted it as one more of so many upsets brought on by the bad situation, and every morning for over a year she would touch his palate with a dash of honey and give him some radish syrup. When the knot in his throat became so oppressive that it was difficult for him to breathe, Aureliano Segundo visited Pilar Tenera to see if she knew of some herb that would give him relief. The dauntless grandmother, who had reached 100 years of age managing a small clandestine brothel, did not trust therapeutic superstitions, so she turned the matter over to her cards. She saw the Queen of Diamonds with her throat wounded by the steel of the Jack of Spades, and she deduced that Fernando was trying to get her husband back home by means of the discredited method of sticking pins into his picture, but that she had brought on an internal tumor because of her clumsy knowledge of the black arts. Since Aureliano Segundo had no other pictures except those of his wedding, and the copies were all in the family album, he kept searching all through the house when his wife was not looking, and finally, in the bottom of the dresser, he came across a half-dozen pessaries in their original boxes. Thinking that the small red rubber rings were objects of witchcraft, he put them in his pocket so that Pilar Tenera could have a look at them. She could not determine their nature, but they looked so suspicious to her that in any case she burned them in a bonfire she built in the courtyard. In order to conjure away Fernanda's alleged curse, she told Aureliano Segundo that he should soak a broody hen and bury her alive under the chestnut tree, and he did it with such good faith that when he finished hiding the turned-up earth with dried leaves, he already felt that he was breathing better. For her part, Fernanda interpreted the disappearance as a reprisal by the invisible doctors, and she sewed a pocket of casing to the inside of her camisole, where she kept the new pessaries that her son sent her. 6 months after he had buried the hen, Aureliano Segundo woke up at midnight with an attack of coughing and the feeling that he was being strangled within by the claws of a crab. It was then that he understood that for all of the magical pessaries that he destroyed and all the conjuring hens that he soaked, the single and sad piece of truth was that he was dying. He did not tell anyone. Tormented by the fear of dying without having sent Amaranta Ursula to Brussels, he worked as hard as he had never done, and instead of one, he made 3 weekly raffles. From very early in the morning he could be seen going through the town, even in the most outlying and miserable sections, trying to sell tickets with an anxiety that could only be conceivable in a dying man. "Here's divine providence," he hawked. "Don't let it get away, because it only comes every 100 years." He made pitiful efforts to appear gay, pleasant, talkative, but it was enough to see his sweat and paleness to know that his heart was not in it. Sometimes he would go to vacant lots, where no one could see him, and sit down to rest from the claws that were tearing him apart inside. Even at midnight, he would be in the red light district trying to console, with predictions of good luck, the lonely women who were weeping beside their phonographs. "This number hasn't come up in 4 months," he told them, showing them the tickets. "Don't let it get away. Life is shorter than you think." They finally lost respect for him, made fun of him, and in his last months they no longer called him Don Aureliano, as they had always done. But they called him Mr. Divine Providence, right to his face. His voice was becoming filled with wrong notes. It was getting out of tune, and it finally diminished into the growl of a dog. But he still had the drive to see that there should be no diminishing of the hope people brought to Petra Kotas's courtyard. As he lost his voice, however, and realized that in a short time he would be unable to bear the pain, he began to understand that it was not through raffled pigs and goats that his daughter would get to Brussels. So he conceived the idea of organizing the fabulous raffle of the lands destroyed by the deluge, which could easily be restored by a person with the money to do so. It was such a spectacular undertaking that the mayor himself lent his aid by announcing it in a proclamation, and associations were formed to buy tickets at 100 pesos apiece, and they were sold out in less than a week. The night of the raffle, the winners held a huge celebration, comparable only to those of the good days of the Banana Company, and Aureliano Segundo, for the last time, played the forgotten songs of Francisco the Man on the accordion, but he could no longer sing them. 2 months later, Amaranta Ursula went to Brussels. Aureliano Segundo gave her not only the money from the special raffle, but also what he had managed to put aside over the previous months, and what little he had received from the sale of the pianola, the clavichord, and other junk that had fallen into disrepair. According to his calculations, that sum would be enough for her studies, so that all that was lacking was the price of her fare back home. Fernanda was against the trip until the last moment, scandalized by the idea that Brussels was so close to Paris and its perdition, but she calmed down with the letter that Father Angel gave her, addressed to a boarding house run by nuns for Catholic young ladies, where Amaranta Ursula promised to stay until her studies were completed. Furthermore, the parish priest arranged for her to travel under the care of a group of Franciscan nuns who were going to Toledo, where they hoped to find dependable people to accompany her to Belgium. While the urgent correspondence that made the coordination possible went forward, Aureliano Segundo, aided by Petra Cotes, prepared Amaranta Ursula's baggage. The night on which they were packing one of Fernanda's bridal trunks, the things were so well organized that the schoolgirl knew by heart which were the suits and cloth slippers she would wear crossing the Atlantic, and the blue cloth coat with copper buttons, and the cordovan shoes she would wear when she landed. She also knew how to walk so as not to fall into the water as she went up the gangplank, that at no time was she to leave the company of the nuns, or leave her cabin, except to eat, and that for no reason was she to answer the questions asked by people of any sex while they were at sea. She carried a small bottle with drops for seasickness, and a notebook written by Father Angel in his own hand, containing 6 prayers to be used against storms. Fernanda made her a canvas belt to keep her money in, and she would not have to take it off even to sleep. She tried to give her the chamber pot, washed out with lye and disinfected with alcohol, but Amaranta Ursula refused it for fear that her schoolmates would make fun of her. A few months later, at the hour of his death, Aureliano Segundo would remember her as he had seen her for the last time, as she tried unsuccessfully to lower the window of the second-class coach to hear Fernanda's last piece of advice. She was wearing a pink silk dress with a corsage of artificial pansies pinned to her left shoulder, her cordovan shoes, with buckles and low heels, and sateen stockings held up at the thighs with elastic garters. Her body was slim, her hair loose and long, and she had the lively eyes that Ursula had had at her age, and the way in which she said goodbye, without crying, but without smiling either, revealed the same strength of character. Walking beside the coach as it picked up speed, and holding Fernanda by the arm so that she would not stumble, Aureliano scarcely had time to wave at his daughter as she threw him a kiss with the tips of her fingers. The couple stood motionless under the scorching sun, looking at the train as it merged with the black strip of the horizon, linking arms for the first time since the day of their wedding. On the 9th of August, before they received the first letter from Brussels, José Arcadio Segundo was speaking to Aureliano in Melquiades's room, and, without realizing it, he said, "Always remember that they were more than 3,000, and that they were thrown into the sea." Then he fell back on the parchments and died with his eyes open. At that same instant, in Fernanda's bed, his twin brother came to the end of the prolonged and terrible martyrdom of the steel crabs that were eating his throat away. 1 week previously, he had returned home without any voice, unable to breathe, and almost skin and bones, with his wandering trunks and his wastrel's accordion, to fulfill the promise of dying beside his wife. Petracotes helped him pack his clothes and bade him farewell without shedding a tear, but she forgot to give him the patent leather shoes that he wanted to wear in his coffin. So when she heard that he had died, she dressed in black, wrapped the shoes up in a newspaper, and asked Fernanda for permission to see the body. Fernanda would not let her through the door. "Put yourself in my place," Petracotes begged. "Imagine how much I must have loved him to put up with this humiliation." "There is no humiliation that a concubine does not deserve," Fernanda replied. "So wait until another one of your men dies and put the shoes on him." In fulfillment of her promise, Santa Sofia de la Piedad cut the throat of José Arcadio Segundo's corpse with a kitchen knife, to be sure that they would not bury him alive. The bodies were placed in identical coffins, and then it could be seen that once more in death they had become as identical as they had been until adolescence. Aureliano Segundo's old carousing comrades laid on his casket a wreath that had a purple ribbon with the words, "Cease, cows. Life is short." Fernanda was so indignant with such irreverence that she had the wreath thrown onto the trash heap. In the tumult of the last moment, the sad drunkards who carried them out of the house got the coffins mixed up and buried them in the wrong graves. Aureliano did not leave Melquiades' room for a long time. He learned by heart the fantastic legends of the crumbling book, the synthesis of the studies of Hermann the Cripple, the notes on the science of demonology, the keys to the Philosopher's Stone, the centuries of Nostradamus and his research concerning the plague, so that he reached adolescence without knowing a thing about his own time, but with the basic knowledge of a medieval man. Any time that Santa Sofia de la Piedad would go into his room, she would find him absorbed in his reading. At dawn she would bring him a mug of coffee without sugar, and at noon a plate of rice and slices of fried plantain, which were the only things eaten in the house since the death of Aureliano Segundo. She saw that his hair was cut, picked off the nits, took in to his size the old clothing that she found in forgotten trunks, and when his mustache began to appear, she brought him Colonel Aureliano Buendia's razor and the small gourd he had used as a shaving mug. None of the latter's children had looked so much like him, not even Aureliano José, particularly in respect to the prominent cheekbones and the firm and rather pitiless line of the lips. As had happened to Ursula with Aureliano Segundo, when the latter was studying in the room, Santa Sofia de la Piedad thought that Aureliano was talking to himself. Actually, he was talking to Melquiades. One burning noon, a short time after the death of the twins, against the light of the window, he saw the gloomy old man with his crow's wing hat, like the materialization of a memory that had been in his head since long before he was born. Aureliano had finished classifying the alphabet of the parchments, so that when Melchiades asked